Rebecca.
And I'm Kaylin.
And you are tuning in to Sociologic here on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from the very top of Burnaby Mountain.
We're stoked to be your host for the next hour, exploring local and global events using sociological perspectives. Thanks for tuning in.
Hi, my name is Kaylin. This is CJSF 90.1 FM on Burnaby Community Radio from Simon Fraser University. We broadcast on the unceded ancestral territory of the Coquitlam, Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. Welcome to the show. So today we are talking a little bit about... piqued our interest of something to talk about is this article that is also a book by David Graeber. And the article is called Bullshit Jobs. We are going to be calling it Meaningless Jobs because we're not supposed to say those things on the radio.
But for anyone that wants to find the book.
if you want to find it, that is what it is called. Essentially, what this introduces is the idea of menial labor, where we have, there's many jobs out there that are, you're doing repetitive tasks. The tasks are not necessarily adding any benefit. People are just not finding joy in these jobs. And part of this is due to a... departure from classic trades being emphasized, and the essentially there used to be many ways to get employment. You could go to trade school, you could do apprenticeships, go to university, but now many people are being funneled into the university education, even though that's not necessarily working out super well for everybody getting employed at the end of that. So a little bit about what he says causes this is the capitalism is integrated into our society, specifically here in the West. The result of that is people need to make money to survive. Therefore, people are working jobs that don't necessarily have their passion or support what they learn. You find I forget the phrase, but there's a way to call this where people who are very qualified, specifically immigrants, are way overqualified for what they're doing. And you find former doctors driving your Uber and such stuff like that, where... a lot of the passion is taking out of the jobs that people are working.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did you pull from this?
I mean, this... I've not really ever thought much about menial labor or, like, this kind of concept of we're heading into a society of more pointless and meaningless jobs than before. So I found the whole article pretty interesting to read and kind of... It's like, what's the phrase? Taking the cloth from your eyes.
The rose-colored glasses?
Yeah, that's it. The rose-tinted, glasses off. There were quite a few, thought-provoking quotes that I took from the article. One of which, I thought was, a very kind of interesting way of wording it. Was that he said the moral and spiritual damage that comes from this situation is profound. It is a scar across our collective soul. This idea that we're heading away from jobs that are significant to everyday happenings and society's functioning and everything to just pointless jobs to make people almost feel accomplished in their lives without actually having a profound effect on society.
Yeah.
And the way that
even not feel accomplished.
Yeah, as well, not feeling accomplished as well. And the way that he's worded that quote, especially it is a scar across our collective soul, it's hauntingly
poetic and
beautiful way of wording it.
Yes, I totally agree.
Because a lot of people I don't think would bother to look at the kind of moral and spiritual damage it's doing on a having on a person, they'll be more looking at like the economic and physical effects that you're seeing, which mm-hmm. is the way, like, we're in a capitalist society where we're so driven by the economic side of things that we're looking at job stability, financial situation, mm-hmm. like the economic capital is ranked so much higher than like your social capital
or physical well-being.
Yeah, physical well-being and things. So for him to say that the moral and spiritual damage is way more profound
mm-hmm.
from this, and you're gonna see it in like there are so many statistics, and I have my issue with statistics in terms of using it as proof, but there is an overwhelming number of statistics in showing the rise of mental health issues and risks.
Yes, for
every
sure.
year it's going up, and that's not just for like young people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's being more researched into older age groups as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, you start as a kid. Follow your dreams. What do you want to be when you grow up? Mm.
What's your passion?
Firefighter, yeah. president, astronaut, all of these things. And then they're like, okay, you're applying for college. What program can you get into? How did your GPA? How's your GPA? How'd you perform on these tests? All of these things. What extracurriculars can you have? And all of those steps, if, say, you're having to do more work at home or you're working to help pay for food and housing and stuff, all of those steps are, you're not going to look, or what's being tracked is not necessarily what's going reflective of all that you're doing to be able to get there.
And when you ask people when they're looking to apply to college or university, and it's kind of like, what do you want to do? Like, what's going to interest you? And I know the amount of my friends that are thinking, oh, what's going to give me the most stable job in the future? What's going to get me the most money that I can live comfortably and not have to worry? It's no longer, what would make you happy?
Yeah.
Like, you're doing this for the next, like, what, 40 years potentially? What's going to make you happy for 40 years to be doing day in and day out?
Or even you get, there's a sort of stigma around the people who are in film and some of the arts of like, oh, so you have the privilege to be able to study something that's not going to make you money, or you don't have to be thinking about it. And yes, that is a very privilege-based thing. But I just look at that, and that's tragic in the sense that why isn't following your dreams enough? But this is a very happy-go-lucky way of looking at it.
Yeah. We'll dive into this quite a bit. I mean, I feel like we went from, like, last week's episode of being quite broad, and this one we've, like, really niched into, like, one thing. Rip it to shreds. Yeah.
But yeah, so we'll start with a song and then we'll come back and we'll have some questions. Here we go.
Do you think that it's okay to wish you were far away? Untie myself from shore and drift aside out to sea with just the tide, out to sea with just the tide. okay to wish you were far away. Untie myself from shore and drift aside, out to sea with just the tide, out to sea with just the tide.
And we are back. That was Boat Song by Lieutenant, a local Vancouver artist. We love to hear it.
I love the local artists.
So going forward to kind of start this conversation out, I think we can talk a little bit about how are different jobs valued?
Mm.
And how is that a social thing versus, I guess, more of the way we perceive it versus how impactful is, how valuable is this job and how important is it?
Yeah.
In terms of necessity, i.e. doctors, it's pretty... I appreciate having doctors.
Yeah, or the healthcare workers are pretty up there. I think it's also interesting because you look back in time and the values of jobs has changed based on how society's changed and society's adapted. So, for like example, you'd look probably back in, this is where I'm going to like struggle to think of an example, but like centuries ago, farmers would have been considered very highly ranked jobs, like very highly valued jobs. That's where you got your food and everything. Whereas like now, it's, I would say, a lot less valued.
I feel like it's pushed to the sides. Yeah. I don't personally know many farmers, and I don't hear about it. I hear about farmers' strikes, but I feel like their voices are being pushed to the side.
Yeah, and I think also they've diversified themselves. This is going off on a little bit of a tangent, but I stayed 2 years ago. I went on holiday in the summer to the Lake District, which is kind of bordering up to Scotland, and it's a really beautiful countryside place, and North England and Scotland is where all like the farmlands are pretty much in England. And and with that, we stayed in a kind of like B&B bed breakfast own house that had been converted by this
beautiful
by this this farmer and his wife and his like family, and his he was the farmer, and they like the wife kind of flips houses and makes them into B&Bs type of thing. That's all nearby. Like, they lived 2 minutes down the road from where we were staying. Mm-hmm. And they gave us a tour of their farm.
Oh, cool.
And when I think of farm, I think of, like, animals and, like, crops and harvest and stuff like that. They had a little bit of that, but they diversified more into wood and, like,
interesting,
transporting wood all across the UK for, like, fireplaces and things. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest part of their revenue. Hmm. And I was like, so that's quite interesting that you're a farmer, yet you've diversified as well to kind of add, I would say, maybe more value to your job.
Yeah.
Because the value's gone down.
For sure.
Over the years.
Georg Simmel talks a little bit about that. He's German sociologist, I believe. He, in his Metropolis and Mental Life, it's an essay about basically the state of mind that the metropolis or the city can have, including things of there's so much, you're getting so much stimulus from living in a city through people, through your phones, through everything. But an aspect of the city that you don't necessarily find in other places is that specialization of things. Mm. For example, a really easy way to understand this is the rubber duck store. Those are in a bunch of the big tourist towns across the world. But you would not find that in a really small town unless they were known for ducks.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to have a market. All of the people living there are not going to just want rubber ducks. You need a certain number of people that are there or passing through that are have that money to then spend on random things and specialization. Or another one would be, I'm trying to think of little specialization stores. basically the idea that there can mm-hmm. be something super specialized because there's a market for it, but
yeah.
that market is only because there's so many people that have an income to then put to be part of that market, which is kind of what I was thinking of this, of how I was connecting to that is the food wasn't necessarily helping with their market, but the wood was, so then they followed into that.
Yeah. I think as well, like, you're adding to, there's this increasing notion that we need to all make ourselves unique, and like we all need to really construct ourselves to the most, like, so there is no one like us in terms of our resumes and things, so that we can only fit a job, we can, we're the only person that can fit like a certain job role, and then that attributes towards job roles becoming more unique as well
and specialized.
Yeah,
and you have to have,
and then you're having an increase in these kind of like pointless jobs because it's like so niche, but it's also kind of like, but you don't need it, all of those things in one role, for example.
Part of a kind of, we were talking about in my class about this, was there used to be the idea of apprenticeships, like I was saying, where you'd go in, you'd have a baseline knowledge, but you wouldn't necessarily have all of the skills. But instead, now you're expected to have those skills before even starting, because they don't have enough time to train people or mentor somebody super closely because they're recruiting so many people at different times. And therefore, you have to come in with all of that experience, all of the know-how that you previously would have just known how to do or would have learned on the job, which is also therefore restricting the number of people that can get different jobs and pushing people into those menial labor jobs.
No, definitely. It's a very weird phenomenon when you're thinking about it and you think kind of like how capitalist society has created all of these meaningless jobs, when it was said in the article, when it was like the kind of the goal kind of behind a capitalist society was to not have menial labor, was to, employers are not going to shell out for employees they do not need. Whereas we've gone to a scenario where there's so much menial labor going on that it's people wearing jobs that aren't necessary.
Yeah.
Which has now been a byproduct of a capitalist society that was never supposed to happen.
And then it goes to, I would say, Marxist ideas of control. With, if your people are working and not necessarily making ends meet, they're very focused on the work because they have to be able to survive. They're not going to be having time for those thoughts of, oh, maybe this structure is not working for me.
Yeah. I'm like saying that the people that, like, through capitalism, and it was like talking about like economic theory and like market competition and things, that the layoffs that happen within these companies is happening on the class of people that are actually like making and kind of contributing to the company, like actually like physically maintaining and fixing and doing like the physical stuff. It seems to all, it's not the like top 1% of the company, right? But all the layoffs happens to them down at the bottom.
Even though you'd save just as much money if you just lay off one of those people.
Exactly. And you, it's like on the tip of my tongue and it's like completely just gone past, because it was linking, it was linking to strikes and striking. And I know, like, the UK, since I started university back in 2022, we have seen a mountain of strikes everywhere, from, like, healthcare workers, doctors. We've had the postal strike here and in the UK. We've had train drivers striking, bus drivers. We had lecturers striking from university.
Wow.
And
I mean, as if you had that last year.
Yeah.
I mean, but with the TAs.
Yeah, and, like, you see all of this happen, and you see how much of an effect it has on society with these jobs, but these are not classed as, like, the, I would say, necessary jobs. But they have the biggest impact when they shut off.
Yeah.
Like,
or
the amount
bus
of...
bus workers.
Yeah. For us back home, it was train strikes. Train strikes were the most inconvenience to everyone. They went on, I think, for like 2 years. I think they're probably still going on to an extent because there's so many different train line companies in the UK. And you're constantly trying to calculate your trip, and then it would be like, I've had it happen to me where it's like, your trip tomorrow is cancelled because of a strike. You can get on the next train. And I was like, that's in 3 hours after, like...
Yeah,
and so that had like, yeah, super inconvenient, had a huge impact on my day that day. But it's like, if you were to talk to someone about them job being a train driver, you're thinking, right, that's like bottom of the pile kind of job, but it has the biggest impact.
Yeah, I feel like, yeah, for sure. I just also with this article, it just opens in a very provocative way. Essentially, it's referencing this person who was writing in 1930, predicting that technology would help us decrease the hours that we would have to work. Because why wouldn't we if we're able to use these machines that make it so those little jobs that nobody really wants to be doing can be done by machines, then we would be able to work less and have much more time for passion and innovation and creativity.
And happiness. Make the world a happier place.
But that's not the case. In America, there's so many people that are working more than just the 40-hour work week. And that's just, it's not healthy. We see that in the effects on people's bodies in terms of chronic illnesses, chronic pain, stress, mental health, like we were saying, and all of the physical results of all of those things.
Yeah, because I'm a very strong believer in that your mental state affects your physical state. So interlinked.
For sure. There's total... Yeah, there's lots of research behind that, too. And it just... What doesn't make sense to me is all of those things will then cost money because... Our healthcare would then have, or, I mean, that the health system would have to take care of all those people that then have to do that. And so it's not necessarily the best economically to be working people this much.
Yeah. And the amount of people that now, because globally we're heading into a global economy that is, like, just... affordability crisis is everywhere in terms of like living standards and wage standards, that you're, oh my gosh, I'm losing my train of thought. I don't know what is going on. I was completely lost it.
Affordability,
living wages. Ah, yes. So my mind's blanking. That you're then forcing people to get more than one job. So they could be working, like, have their, say, main career job.
Yep.
That they're working 9 to 5, 5 days a week, Monday to Friday, and doing, like, potentially 40-plus hours, to then having to get a job Saturday, Sunday as well.
Or even after work. Working at a bar or a restaurant.
And so you're then having, like, days where you're probably not getting, like, probably 5 hours sleep, if that, to then go and fulfill your job role the next day. You're not going to do it to a great standard.
I know, that's not creating a productive citizen.
Yeah, you're not going to do it to a great standard. You're not exactly going to be the happiest person unless you absolutely love everything you're doing, which is, I think, to weigh that up against exhaustion.
Yeah, it's even when I'm tired, I can't love the things I love as much as I love them when I'm fully rested and
Because all you're thinking about is like how good it would feel right now to lay down and shut my eyes.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and she says as she yawns.
Yes. You were painting such a beautiful picture.
Yeah, but it's this idea that you're overworking everyone to then having like multiple jobs, just to be able to live.
Yeah, and then it's just why is that?
The big sociological why.
I feel like...
I think as well, like, with you saying this guy writing in the 1930s about how technology is going to be innovative and it's going to change the way we are, we're all, like, going to have more time on our hands. And I would say to an extent, yes, maybe some people do get more time on their hands, but then they're not... They're filling it with these second jobs and things because they can't.
Or it's the people who have made money off of the technology that could have been making our lives easier, but isn't.
Yeah, there's a really, oh, this has reminded me of, I saw this, it's not like a meme, but it was like, it was something on Instagram, it was like a post I saw, and it was talking about how AI has been created, I'm gonna word it wrong, it was like AI has been created so that I can, it can do like the task of like writing an essay for you or writing up a poem or whatever, like creating a picture that you wanted, for example, like doing kind of more the creative stuff AI can do for you, so you have time to do like your laundry and washing up and things like that. And it's saying, but what I wanted was AI to be able to do the laundry, washing up and like the menial stuff so that I could do the creative stuff, but it's been flipped the other way.
Exactly. I feel like there's just for me, my personal take on this is that there's a lot of humanity that can be found in the arts and creativity and imagination and all of those things that are kind of not, they're not rewarded in the systems that we have, like the school systems and the job market, necessarily, for the most part. And it, that's the part that I see a lot of AI is just scary, in the sense that it's taking away that human aspect of it. And it's really cool that it creates super cool things, but I feel like there's something cathartic in like sitting down, writing a poem, drawing a little picture, doing some painting, especially with other people or by yourself, whatever floats your boat. And that was something he was talking about too, of there's those super super good artists, poets, writers, etc. But because the cost of living is so high, they don't get to just pursue their passion.
Oh, yes, the story about his musician friend.
Yeah.
Or something, and it's gone into a law, corporate law instead.
Yeah, because one of their albums didn't do well, and then he had to pivot because he had a family and needed to be able to pay for food for his kid.
Yeah, I took a quote from that where he was taking the default choice of so many directionless folk law school.
Yeah.
And it was just with like that, I mean, this is like delving kind of mixing what we spoke about last week, but the like the pressure to follow the capitalist societal structure of going to university as your next step after 18, does it fuel the expansion of meaningless jobs? Because it's kind of the default choice. Like he was saying, the default choice of the direction list. People then end up going to university, potentially not knowing what they want to do, what career they want to go into. I mean, you're 18. You don't really know what you want your future to be, so they pick just like any random thing.
Yeah.
And I look at the proportion of my friends that went into law for university, or they did law with something.
I feel like business.
Yeah, too, business is another one.
I mean, in full honesty, that's why I picked sociology, is because I thought it was super applicable. I thought it was interesting, and that's why I picked it over, say, business or something. But for me, it applies. I want to work with people. And so I saw that as an, I'd learn about people and then I'd go work with people. But
yeah, because for me, I picked sociology and criminology just because I had a passion for the subject, and I